Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. If film in 1983 could be defined by a single moment, what would it be? Well, in the running would be Tom Cruise sliding into his living room in his underpants, dancing to Bob Seger's old-time rock and roll. If disco was about escape and fantasy, rock and roll was about rebellion, sticking it to the man, and not playing by the rules. In 1981, MTV launched onto the airwaves with the phrase,
"Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll."
And pop culture, movie making, and the very idea of the rock star would never be the same again. So by 1983, filmmakers who saw this new fast cuts, bright colors, in-your-face approach to youth culture had had time to incorporate it into their films, for better or for worse. Cam, MTV, big frickin' deal. What happened?
Well, MTV.
Yeah, what happened? Yeah. Jersey Shore.
What? Like, yeah. Well, I'm not going to tell you the entire history of MTV, but we know that MTV started in late 1981 and was almost immediately hugely influential on culture. The interesting ways it trickles into film is the fact that it kind of takes a while. It surprises America is kind of what people say. There's a bit of a thought that the early 80s are what's considered the second British invasion. And part of the reason that existed was American artists were less used to creating music videos than European artists were. So in 1983, especially, which I guess I'll focus in on, you saw still American artists were mostly making performance videos, videos that just showed them doing what they did, while British artists were making crazy stuff like Blinded Me with Science and Hungry Like the Wolf and Come on Eileen, just like some of the most classic cinematic videos of the 1980s. But of course, 1983 is also, it should be said, the release of Thriller, which is arguably the most cinematic music video of the time, and maybe of all time. It's still kind of considered a short film. It's an interesting time for rock music. There was a bit of this fragmentation with like the anti-disco backlash. There was a bit of a slump. It was a big time for touring musicians, but yeah, people were like trying to figure out how MTV works. It's also a very interesting time because the Reagan administration had an odd relationship with rock music. In 1983, there was a very hilarious moment where the 4th of July festivities in Washington were supposed to be headlined by the Beach Boys.
These are the Beach Boys' previous headlines. But Interior Secretary James Watt says this year will be different. Rock will be banned. Watt, who refused our request for an interview, told the Washington Post, "We had the rock bands attracting the wrong element. You couldn't bring your family down to the mall." The Beach Boys, as you can see, attracted a mob of college-age whites drinking lots of beer and smoking, it seems, some marijuana.
keep in mind, again, we were talking about the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And they instead went for Wayne Newton.
Oh, well, yeah. That's...
Which was considered particularly pathetic even for Reagan.
That's definitely the antidote to rock right there.
Yes. Mm. And the same week, Reagan was like, no, no, I'm a fan of the Beach Boys. Like, he even backpedaled, like, listen, I'm not that lame. I enjoy the music of the Beach Boys. So, yeah, you can think that rock was cool and kind of outsider-y, interestingly. And in Hollywood, you saw that come around in the early 80s, even before MTV, with movies like The Forbidden Zone with Oingo Boingo. You saw Heavy Metal, of course, a classic animated Canadian film. The Wall in 1982, Pink Floyd's basically a music video. Turned into, you know, it's a bunch of music videos stitched together. Movies like Wild Style to kind of get into the other stuff. In 1983, there was films like Eddie and the Cruisers and Suburbia and Valley Girl, which we talk about on the show. They're all very influenced by the music. But yeah, like I say, there's interestingly a vein of animated films, especially in 1981 with both Heavy Metal and Ralph Bakshi's American Pop. And in 1983, there's a bit of a lost Canadian rock animated film as well, which we're going to talk about.
Totally. But I think part of you're seeing this too is because the late 70s were such a big time for like rock stars. Mm-hmm. Like you had the Rolling Stones still on tour at their prime. You had Aerosmith now touring. You had these giant names and this swagger. And you also had all these punk bands that had been going at the same mm-hmm. time. So people like Iggy Pop. Then you're getting these stories because now people are coming out of that who were like young and had worked with these bands as roadies or had worked at the venues who were now in the film and television industry making these stories. And our first movie is actually going to deal with that. I love the movie Rock and Roll High School unironically. I think mm-hmm. it is one of the best pieces of cinema. It makes me laugh so hard
really
every
good.
Time I watch it. Anytime they refer to Joey Ramone as Dreamy, I just lose it. It's just so funny for me. And PJ Souls as Riff Randall is the best. I can't wait till we get to that that year in a year in film just so I can gush about it.
Is that 1979?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. It's coming. But what if you sped Rock and Roll High School up to 11, added a meta element, Malcolm McDowell doing a Mick Jagger impersonation, Daniel Stern holding a chimpanzee while wearing a Tarzan costume, and musical performances from people like Lee Ving of Fear and Lou Reed, you would have 1983's Get Crazy. It's a movie I can only truly describe as frenetic. Both Rock and Roll High School and Get Crazy were directed by Alan Arkush. Arkush was a Corman director, but his roots came from rock and roll. Alicia, you know a bit about him.
Yeah. So when we say he was a Corman director, and it's funny how many filmmakers we have talked about both on the podcast so far and on the show A Year in Film started out with Corman, just quite a number. Like he really was this kind of apprenticeship program for people that would become very important filmmakers. But he, particularly with director Joe Dante, they both worked for Corman in the same capacity in that edited all of Corman's trailers. So they would edit trailers for things like Death Race 2000 and sort of like the really famous kind of schlocky Corman films. And then eventually started directing Corman films until they became their own filmmakers. Alan Arkush, I really love. He grew up kind of as a stagehand for concerts, specifically in New York at Fillmore's East, which is one of the most famous music venues of all time. And Get Crazy, his film from 1983, is really an homage to that kind of like, we must put on a show. Those kinds of legendary nights that would happen at Fillmore East where you would have bands that, you know, you would show up not even knowing who's on the marquee and you would see legendary performers. So that's really what he's going with this film. You're describing it as frenetic, Becky, which I completely agree with you. And I just want to say like the tagline, like on the poster to this film is say goodbye to your brain.
Like, they're not wrong. You had this with Sgt. Pepper's. I had mm-hmm. this with this where I was mm-hmm. like, does this movie exist? Like, mm-hmm. or am I just imagining this whole thing?
Well, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Like, Sgt. Pepper definitely exists. There is an argument or a question as to whether Get Crazy exists because it's had incredible rights issues and incredible, the studio basically made it fail on purpose. So Alan Arkush, Rock and Roll High School was a huge success, and that really cemented his career that he could move away from Corman, although he didn't want to. Like, I remember Corman told him with Rock and Roll High School, if you make this a hit, you'll never have to work for me again. And that ended up being true. but he had made in 1981 Heart Beeps, which is a film that stars Bernadette Peters and Andy Kaufman in his last role. It was one of the most dismal box office disasters of all time.
Well, they're robots, aren't they?
They are robots. Stan Winston did the makeup and the special effects and actually was nominated for an Academy Award.
I was going to say, worth noting, an Oscar-nominated film.
So Heartbeats is an Oscar-nominated film, but I actually think there's merit to Heartbeats. I don't think it should be, people should be so harsh on it. I would recommend seeing it. We bring up Heartbeats because despite Rock and Roll High School being a huge hit, his 1981 film was a disaster. So he really wasn't in a power seat when it came to Get Crazy. He wanted this film to be more serious and more based in reality. And we've already talked about this on the podcast, but because Airplane was such a huge hit, the studio, which was, I believe, MGM, forced him to basically make it an Airplane, like a parody, a spoof, a satire, make it really, really silly. Alan Arkush describes this film as having 1,500 jokes and 2,500 punchlines. And
he's not wrong.
He's not wrong. It's so true. Like, there's punchlines that you don't even understand which joke it belongs to. It's frenetic was the best description I could think of, Becky, so thank you for that.
my pleasure.
and it takes place over one night. It's New Year's Eve, and it's a theater called the Saturn Theater, which is based on the Fillmore's, that is going to be probably developed into a condo by an evil music producer played by, you know, consummate evil man, Ed Begley Jr.
I love, in a full silver space suit.
I love him.
With Fabian and Donovan following alongside him. Oh, my God. Yeah. And they keep shooting. I mean, he's a giant Nordic man to begin with, but they keep shooting him from underneath. So he looks even bigger. But that space suit, man, I love it.
He's so good in this. I think everyone's good in this. And, you know, the stage manager for this theater, which is played by Daniel Stern from what is that? What's the film?
Your Childhood, Home Alone.
Yeah, Home Alone. But I think, City Slickers. He's going to, like, make this concert the biggest night yet and make sure that he's going to, you know, stop this condo developer. It's basically the plot of one of the Muppet movies, if I think about it. I think, like, the first Disney Muppet movie is almost an exact ripoff of Get Crazy, which I think is fascinating. And I did talk to Alan Arkush about that, and he did not see it. But it's okay. He shot that question down in about... He smiled while he was shooting me down, but I do appreciate that. And so you get these, you know, all these musicians you're discussing, Becky, someone like Lou Reed plays Auden. They're obviously not playing themselves. They're all sort of caricatures of their own musical personas, including Lee Ving from Fear, who plays Piggy, this sort of like, well, and here was my Muppet thing. I'm like, Piggy's animal. Like, I had like a referent for every character in Get Crazy. I was like, here's your Kermit. Here's your Miss Piggy. Here's your animal. He still did not buy it. But
this is your rabbit hole, dude.
Yeah, like, I know.
I'm just saying, this is your personal conspiracy theory. I'm waiting for the red string to come out.
My partner's like, can you just get through one Q&A without comparing something to the Muppet Show? And I'm like, probably not.
It is the ultimate commentary on culture and film and theater, so I get it.
I will say that the Muppets do a lot less cocaine in this movie.
Yeah, there's also Malcolm McDowell, who is not a rock star, but in fact a very large star, playing, as you say, Becky, a Mick Jagger character called Reggie Wanker, which made Mick Jagger quite angry and quite litigious.
I also thought that he was a bit of a Johnny Rotten, because he was like a punk guy who sold out.
I see a little bit that.
But he's more glam,
he's
isn't
more
he?
Glam.
Which sits more almost Gary Glitter, you know, put a pin in that one, but like that sort of era.
I see more Mick Jagger for the whole everything around the music, like the orgies that occur in this film, the ego. Like, obviously maybe Johnny Rotten had orgies. I'm sure he did. I don't know. But in terms of the orgies in this film, they're very Rolling Stones central. And there's a scene where, and this is probably the most infamous scene in the film, and I think it's one of the funniest, where Reggie Wanker has a full dialogue with his penis in the bathroom.
Yes, yeah, that's right. That's how the movie ends.
And that's the one part where I'm like, I guess the Muppet Show didn't do that.
No.
Like, that's like where the Muppet Show diverges. But this is just a really silly, silly, fun film. It also has Gail Edwards, who's playing someone who's kind of helping Daniel Stern's character get the theater together. Her character's name is Willie Loman.
Of all things. Of it's wonderful.
Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Yeah. Like, why
Not
is
sure
that a
why.
Reference? Yeah, if I could do that Q&A over again, I would ask Alan Arkish about that one. What's really sad about this film is it was sold out basically during production. So eventually Alan Arkish figured out that the studio had sold the shares of this film to a Wall Street tax shelter, meaning that it was designed and produced to fail so that MGM could make money off of its failure. It's essentially insurance fraud. I mean, it's not. This is all legal, and this happens a lot. It's also the plot of the producers. Like, basically, this film got Max Bialy stalked, but then went on to become this huge cult hit. It was very unavailable. Even on home media, it was very unavailable. At the time that my partner showed this, we could only really show it, if you wanted to show it in a quality version, you could only show it with like the one or two 35 millimeter prints that existed.
Alan Arkish, in his excellent Trailers from Hell, actually talks about trying to hunt down the negatives.
In the transfer of the movie back and forth for these different shell companies, the negative was lost, as well as the entire soundtrack. Lost. I checked all the film vaults. It was gone. Could not be found, which is why it's never been on DVD. It was crushing.
It's another film that I'm like, it's just, you need to see it done right. You need to see it on a proper restoration and or on the big screen would be wonderful because the music performances are so good. They're so fun. And there's this sort of thread that you're going to see a Lou Reed performance. And it does happen, but it happens in a very surprising way. I think this is a really, I have a lot of heart for this film.
You love this movie.
I do, yeah.
But that having been said, I mean, like you said, it was sold out because he had originally planned this film to be a lot more realistic and a lot more gritty. And I love what we have. I'm not going to lie. I do love this like wild airplane thing because I feel like that increases its rewatchability of like, oh, I didn't see that last time. This is happening here. And I would want to watch it with like a large group at midnight, as it was probably intended to be watched, to just hear all the different reactions and like have people call out the screen and have that kind of chaos in the theater emulating what you're seeing on the screen.
Yeah.
But hearing some of the stories that Alan Arkish has about like being at the Fillmore, he's got one here which I love. He was talking about Joe Cocker and the Mad Dogs and Englishmen showing up at the theater, and they brought their space choir, which was like a couple dozen people, who also brought their kids and their dogs, and the dogs were running around stage, and someone dropped a baby, and apparently the stage manager had to gather everybody around and say, okay, guys, dogs go outside, we stop dropping babies, and then we do the show. That's the movie I kind of also want to see. I want them both to exist.
Yeah. I mean, Alan Arkish is, if you know Trailers from Hell, you can tune in. He does great interviews with like all the directors that work for Corman, and he's really kind of become this film and pop culture commentator. Part of me, and a lot of the questions that were asked at this particular screening were, what are you working, like, what's your next film? And he's working a lot on television. Like, he's doing so much. He directs Nashville when that was on and a bunch of shows. You know, people who love this film are just like, we want to see you do more of this, updated for, like, 2020. And I personally would love that. I would love to see him return to this. And I think he would maybe get his vision realized and make it more serious. But no matter what, there's still going to be crazy jokes. I mean, this is the director of Heartbeeps and Rock and Roll High School. So, like, it's still going to be very tongue-in-cheek and very, very silly and a very fun film to put on if you have, like, a party and you don't necessarily need to tune into every piece of dialogue. But, like, people will stop and stand in front of the, like, screen and watch Malcolm McDowell have a full conversation with his penis.
This is exactly the kind of movie I was talking about, which, like, you play this in the background of a party and it's fun
it's
super
film.
Cool. Not the day after, but this one.
No, don't show the day after. I should also mention that I think I've characterized this incorrectly. The penis does talk back to him. So he's not just talking.
You don't actually, we need to be clear that you don't actually see the penis.
You
it's
don't.
All
no.
done. Yeah.
No, there's
I will
a
also
little
say
voice.
You can have an unusual double bill because there is also the helicopter action movie Blue Thunder stars Malcolm McDowell and Daniel Stern.
Oh, so, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Daniel Stern may not make it through the whole movie, but yes, 1983 was a big year for that pairing for some
That's
reason.
That's awesome. There's also a lot of like Corman. If you love Roger Corman, there's a lot of, you have a lot of Corman actors like Paul Bertel and Mary Warrenoff. And I think Dick Miller's in this
in
a
he
very,
shows up.
Yep.
Dick Miller's in every single single film. So, I mean, you just have to, like, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. Like, he's in everything. But I love Dick Miller. This is just, I just think this is so fun. And 1983 seems to be a big year for satire and for, like, parodies. And this is maybe the best of them.
There's also weird trivia associated with this film because there are so many people in it that apparently Anna Bjorn, who plays Reggie's, like, sister slash partner in this, she's the one who called in the tip that brought down Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, what is up? How is that even possible? Weird. You mentioned that, and I was like, I had to like look it up. I was like, what is the connection there?
Isn't that bizarre? So, yeah, I mean, Hollywood, right? Like,
yeah.
I guess that's just it, is you're just around and you get mixed up with all sorts of crazy folks, possibly at Fillmore's if you're in New York. But yeah, this just, because there's just so many people, you just have so many different connections. And I love stories about working with curmudgeons. Like,
are you going to talk about Lou Reed right now because he's the ultimate curmudgeon?
I'm totally going to talk about Lou Reed right now because I feel so bad because I'm a huge Lou Reed fan as well. Like, I even kind of like Metal Machine Music. Like, okay, that's my little, like, Alan Arkush was also a huge fan and, like, really wanted this to be a good experience for him. And Lou Reed kept going back and forth on if he liked the script, hated the script, was going to do it, wasn't going to do it. And so he decided he was going to make a mixtape for Lou Reed of all this jazz. And as Lou Reed started going through, he was giving notes on the mixtape, being like, well, why did you pick this one of his? Like, you should have taken this one. This one sucks. Like, what were you thinking? And his wife, Sylvia, had to say, Lou, he's gone out of his way to be nice to you. Just be nice.
Don't be a dick. Well, I think also if you Google a photo of Alan Arkush during this period of time, and I'm not saying this as a judgment, he is a goofy looking guy. Obviously a very talented, very like efficient filmmaker. I really like his films, but like he had this big, like big fro of like curly brown hair, super skinny. Like I'm picturing when you told that story, I'm picturing him talking to Lou Reed. I'm like, yeah, that's someone who gets walked over by Lou Reed in some ways.
But Lou Reed also, like, he set him up for a lot of things that Lou Reed would love. Like,
yes.
The first time you see the character of Auden, he's staged in a way that looks like a Bob Dylan album cover. It's really clever the way they're going about this.
Apparently, so Alan Arkush said, I hope I'm remembering this story properly, Lou Reed didn't watch the film until many years after it was, well, I mean, it didn't really get released. So Lou Reed eventually saw it. And in some run-in, kind of not far off from when Lou Reed died, he let Alan Arkush know he apologized for being a dick and also said he really enjoyed the film. And he really actually liked the song, that the way he performs the song. And I do think it appears at some point on one of the Lou Reed, like, posthumous best of hits or something like that. But
the track is Little Sister, and I agree with you. And it's what makes me really want to see a real version of this, because the way it's shot is like the calmest moment in the whole film. And it's so intimate and loving. And you understand the heart of why he loves these performances and why live performance matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, play it loud, see it live. Like, that's kind of the mantra. And what is the tagline? Like, turn off your brain, forget your brain, something like that. That's how to watch this film.
Watch for the giant walking joint that gets smoked.
Or Larry, Electric Larry, the drug dealer.
Whenever you guys are taking this movie very seriously, I'm like, there's a giant joint that goes to the concert.
Electric Larry, the drug dealer, is pretty great. Yeah, that's a great
character. Never explained.
Well, speaking of creative from the heart projects that got butchered so hard by a studio, our next film hits pretty close to home for myself and for Canadians everywhere. If you grew up in Canada in the 80s or 90s, Nelvana is a name you probably became familiar with when you watched cartoons. And that's because this little studio that could became a powerhouse with hits like Care Bears, Inspector Gadget, Tintin, Babar, and Franklin. But before they conquered your childhood, they made a foray into adult animation. The Nelvana team of Patrick Loubert, Michael Hirsch, and Clive A. Smith started out making a cute kids movie called Drats, and then they decided to turn it into an adult animated show, and Clive A. Smith, the director of the film, had very specific intentions for it.
My inspiration for Rock and Roll was life itself, music, and art, rock and roll music, it's not called rock and roll, it's rock and roll.
animation in Canada was not an easy thing, but it was a big thing. And weirdly, we got a lot of stuff from the UK to begin with, for example, Clive A. Smith. But a lot of our animation filmmakers came up through the National Film Board and through the CBC. These are huge training grounds and places where people were really able to experiment things in a relatively safe sort of way. And so you get groundbreaking, quite frankly, films like 1983's Rock and Rule. I really love this movie. And Cam, this is another one that was almost totally lost.
Yeah, it's a movie that interestingly was kind of thrown off by the end of United Artists. It was a film that was developed for United Artists. And as that collapsed and got taken over by MGM, the change in leadership essentially left them with a movie they didn't care about. So when you look up a release date, this is 1983's Rock and Rule, very much in a strange sense, because it was sort of released then, sort of released 5 years later, sort of released on TV in Canada in 1986. It is a movie that just, yeah, had a super botched release, considering it's full of the biggest rock stars of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a movie that weirdly was difficult to find for a long time. There was a VHS release in 1980 and a Laserdisc in 86. Those had very small printings that almost immediately went out of print. There then wasn't a DVD till 2005. And then there was a Blu-ray, I think, in 2011 that is now pretty gone. We're lucky now that the rights holders have put it on YouTube through a thing called Retro Rerun. But yeah, it's a movie that just nobody cared enough about, and it kind of never got a proper release.
A number of the films we've talked about in this series have been about MGM, but some weird stuff was going down at MGM that they were butchering stuff left and right.
Yeah, I mean, for those of our listeners who aren't up to speed on their studio history of the last century, MGM, you know, it was the most prestigious studio of Hollywood's golden era. If you think about The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, like, MGM was the A studio. Like, it was high production value, and, you know, people would clamor to any release that MGM did. Come to the 1980s, that could not be further from the case. It really was a sad decline. And that sale that you're talking about, Cam, earlier, where they acquired United Artists, I believe in 1980 or 1981, ostensibly bankrupted them. It was not a smart business move. By the early 80s, they had to kind of switch from a studio that was producing their own films to a distributor of independent productions. And there's very few bankable films in the 1980s for MGM. We talked about War Games earlier on an episode. Now, that is one of them. War Games made a lot of money, as did like Rocky II, Poltergeist in 1982, and Octopussy, the like kind of off-brand, one of the off-brand James Bonds.
That's the on-brand James Bond.
Oh, sorry.
I will say,
okay,
never say never again is the off-brand.
Got it. There's two in 1983 that we get kind of confused about. So those made money. That's it, though. If you compare them to Paramount and Universal, they were drawing about 30% of what Paramount and Universal were bringing to the box office. So they switched to distribution. And I think that switch from this powerful, powerful studio that was making their own films to acquiring things like Rock and Rule, which came to them through the United Artists acquisition. Yeah, how do you make that switch? It's really, really hard. And they didn't do a very good job of it, actually. There's a lot of films that fall through the cracks that I think today are worthy films. I think this is a worthy film. I was blown away by Rock and Rule. I had never seen it before diving into this podcast. And also, sadly, even in like 2020, as someone who books films, there's a lot of MGM titles that fall through the cracks that are just like not in copies that you can get, and the rights are all messed up. Part of the rights for Rock and Rule, my suspicion, has to do with music rights, which anytime you have a film like Get Crazy, which anytime you have music rights with like big artists that are repped by Sony or these, you know, huge Warners, these huge music labels, it's a nightmare. Like, it's a total nightmare trying to renew the rights for 50 years down the road.
And we need to talk about some of the big stars involved with this, because you've got Deborah Harry. Once again, you've got Lou Reed. You've got Iggy Pop hangs out in here playing a giant demon. You got Earth, Wind, and Fire. Once again, thank you, Sergeant Pepper. And Cheap Trick is the male singing voice for Omar.
Mm-hmm.
In this film that, like, once again, the plot kind of matters and kind of doesn't, but apparently there's like a major edit butchery job again that was done by MGM. But it is so beautiful, and the music is so good, and the voice acting is so good that you're just like, where did this little thing come from? It's wild.
This is a scary film. If I saw this as a kid, I think that might be sort of the confusion around promoting it and distributing it is, you know, we, and we've talked about this on the podcast when we did Watership Down, like you, there's this misnomer that animation's for children. This film is scary. It's strangely sexual. And it's about basically the apocalypse and Armageddon. It's very 2020. Watching this, I was oh, yeah, we're going to be these rat people pretty soon. It's not New York, it's Nuke York.
I'm just like, I love it. Sure. I'm a pun girl. Yeah, I love it.
There's a lot of puns. The part of the fight, but the difference between United Artists and MGM was, I believe MGM was a little more interested in an adult animated film. And United Artists was fine with a kind of like older teen movie. Mm-hmm. So that's a weird, because this is based on a children's film as well. It's Nelvana made a short thing called The Devil and Daniel Mouse, which is more or less the same plot, but in a cute country band kind of way.
That too is really scary. Like the characters are, Nelvana's known for when they did their original animation for these like really long faces and like exaggerated features and big lips on certain characters. And they're human, but not at the same time. It's just very exaggerated.
I find Care Bears, which is Nelvana, terrifying.
Sure.
It's
a threat.
Even when they're trying to be preschool, I'm like, oh, sweet God.
But yeah, when you talk about music rights, the kind of crazy thing is that this film never had a soundtrack. There was never a release of these, at the time, original songs. Most of these people have gone on to record these songs in some form or another. But yeah, the fact that you have these songs, and even, you know, the plot's a little scant. It's kind of a fun, weird anthropomorphic animal people get into trouble. But the music is amazing. I think maybe even better than Get Crazy, which has great music too.
Oh, for sure.
And nobody phoned this in. No. So you listen to people like Deborah Harry.
That song is really one of the songs that I couldn't get out of my mind. The melody is very, very haunting.
And then Iggy Pop.
It was freeing in a way because I didn't have to be me, which is rather nice.
And then Lou Reed being like,
I felt very positive towards Mock because there are many things to work with him. I could identify with him up to a point. The way he looked, the things he said, the kind of things he believed in, there were a lot of ways I could relate to that. And even though I don't necessarily think that way, I could really bite into his character.
People love this, and it shows. And the music, like, I mean, any one of these people could have just been like, yeah, here's something from, like, my G catalog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, and they really show up for this.
Part of it is the fact that this was, they did the music before the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't really have a script as much. They had a loose outline, but they animated to the music. So a lot of what you see, the movement is so realistic, partially because they were working off of these performances and making the music really the focal point.
I think that coming back to Sgt. Pepper's, once again, Earth, Wind, and Fire steal the show. Like, that seems to be like a running theme. Like, if you have Earth, Wind, and Fire on your soundtrack or in your film, it's like that performance really stood out for me because it's, you wouldn't think going up against Iggy Pop, Lou Reed, Deborah Harry, which are very different musical genres, that it would work, but it did. And it makes sense what you're saying, Cam, that the animation style flows so well. Mm-hmm. You know, these are anthropomorphized. They kind of look like rat, chipmunk, dog, goof troop. There's
yeah.
a weird...
It's a bit of goof even, troop, yeah.
It's a bit
That's
of goof troop.
What they're supposed to be. Like I said, originally it was Drats. And then you do get this like weird crawl that was apparently added by MGM at the beginning to like explain
the
world.
Yeah, yeah,
the
Star Wars crawl.
And also give away the reveal that Mock is trying to... Mock is the bad guy. Mock Swagger, obviously, is trying to end the world. But that's actually meant to be the big reveal. But for some reason, they give it away in the opening crawl.
I have a very hard time, and maybe Cam, you know more about this, piecing together. I watched this on Amazon Prime.
Sure.
And maybe listeners, it might still be on Amazon Prime. I have no idea. But my sense is I watched the American version, which had a different voice actor for one of the characters, had that crawl, which I found annoying. Cam, you watched the Canadian version on YouTube?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Retro rerun in Canada. It might be geo-blocked, I will say,
probably.
For any listeners
it
outside of Canada.
It probably is, yeah.
because I believe it's an official one from the rights holders. But yeah, it's, I mean, the differences aren't huge. As you say, Paul LaMatt from American Graffiti voices Omar in the American version. They wanted a star like Paul LaMatt, forgotten star of American Graffiti. There's still the crawl in the Canadian one. Quite a lot of the MGM changes are actually present in the Canadian. But yeah, it's very...
They even changed the dialogue for the two things. So like when you watch the American version, it feels weird and choppy because they're not responding to what they're actually delivering.
That's weird.
Well, I'm sure that it's kind of the best Canadian voice talent available.
It is the best Canadian. I'm gonna get into this. Becky, the voice actor, yes. is like, here we go. We've got
those
back.
Are fighting words, Cam. Yeah. Apparently, you just enacted the Becky's in go mode.
My hands got very emphatic. I was like, you need to know. because you need to know about people like Don Franks.
Yeah.
I mean, he played Dr. Claw in Inspector Gadget, Sabretooth in X-Men, the animated series, a bunch of voices in ALF, the animated series. He had roles in the Ewoks and Star Wars Droids animated series, including being the voice of Bubba Fett. And he is so good as Mock Swagger that when he shows up in this big, grand entrance, his voice is also indistinguishable from David Bowie just for a moment.
Anyone want a beer?
I'm sure more than a few people had a double take on that one.
Any gravelly bad guy is Don Franks for the most part.
He's also the father of a dynasty of actors and voice actors, including Cree Summer Franks, who just, I believe she just goes by Cree Summer now, and Rainbow Frank. And they're both like huge deals now.
That's very cool.
The other person that you need to pay attention to is Susan Roman, who has, again, a huge resume, and people will know her. She's also in heavy metal. Most of those people were kicking around that kind of area. But she's known for playing Sailor Jupiter in the Canadian dub of Sailor Moon. That's her big claim to fame. But yeah, like her resume is absolutely ridiculous. And I don't think people give Canadians enough credit for like how strong their voice performances are. Mm-hmm. And that like most of these are the voices of people's childhoods and they don't know they're Canadian actors.
All those shows you just named, I'm like, oh my God. Except for ALF, the animated series, which I was not a fan of because he ate cats.
Listen, it's crazy that he never ate a cat on the TV show.
But, but if he was going to eat a cat, it was going to be on the animated series, I figured.
No, I really love this movie. I think it's so beautiful. I'm glad people are seeing it now. I think also it's got some like weirdly empowering female characters in it too. Like Angel, who's the main character, who's this singer that Mock is like trying to use her voice to open up this portal to hell and end the world because he's not selling enough tickets to his concert.
He didn't sell two tickets. It wasn't sold out and that made him angry.
I love it. I love it so much. He has this trio of sidekicks who are like, you know, like the Beagle Boys, I guess, from Scrooge McDuck. They have a sister named Cindy, played by Catherine Gallant, who is just like, she's so empowered and she's like, we're going to go out. We're going to have fun. She roller skates everywhere. She's just so cool and so much fun. And like, I want to be her best friend.
She was my, I love Mock, but she was my favorite character. It's like Cinderella, right? She's like she's ridiculous. She's like almost in a cheerleader's uniform. But she's got like giant wide shoulders. Such a unique animation choice to design her that way.
Oh, yeah.
But how much that this is not a children's movie that like people get vaporized and melted and like the demons at the end are genuinely frightening and really cool looking. Like it's very rock and roll and it is very in your face.
I would say like 14 and up. 13 and up.
Definitely the demon. I also find the bad henchwoman, what's her face, with the creepy pull-off face disturbing.
Is her name Auntie something? No.
Oh, no, that's Catherine O'Hara, who's the tattoo artist.
Right, the tattoo artist is Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah, that's, I think it's a very early...
Stop and think about that for a second. Yeah. That's crazy.
Who would go on to be in Nightmare Before Christmas as a voice as well. So, she's...
And, I mean, Catherine O'Hara is also known for her fashion, playing the character of Moira on Schitt's Creek. So we need to come back and talk about some serious fashion and sexy vampires from 1983. One of these films was based on a novel by one of the most famous alien abductees in the world. We're going to find out about that as well as orgasm feeding aliens after the break. It's going to be a weird one, guys. Hey, listeners, if you're enjoying the podcast, season 2 of the TV show is coming out December 6th.
And you'll be able to see episodes covering 1975, 1986, 1994, and 2000. Not only will you see the faces of Cam, Alicia, and myself, and they're good faces, very expressive, but you're also going to hear from so many more film experts, and maybe even some filmmakers talking about the movies you love. And here's where it gets even better. Hollywood Suite is in free preview for the whole month of December, and you can watch both seasons of A Year in Film and great movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Don't forget to watch the first season of A Year in Film now and find out how to catch the free preview while it lasts at hollywoodsuite.ca. You know that Hollywood Suite airs great content, and they've got a real treat lined up. December 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the 2000s channel is the premiere of Valley of Tears, a 10-part HBO Max original drama series. You'll be able to watch the first two episodes back-to-back, and then each subsequent episode will air weekly after that on Saturdays. Have raucous Saturday night plans? Don't worry. After the episodes air, they're going to be available on Hollywood Suite On Demand exclusively. Listeners, the trailer alone for Valley of Tears is gorgeous, which makes sense because it's Israel's highest budget TV series ever, and clearly every dollar is on that screen. It follows four soldiers caught in the crossfire of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. I'm excited to watch it, one, because I know nothing about the Yom Kippur War and would like to know more about it, and two, because when people ask me what I'm watching, I'm going to be like, oh, just this amazing HBO Max original 10-part series called Valley of Tears that's airing exclusively on Hollywood Suite in Canada, and then a conversation will be started. Check out hollywoodsuite.ca for more information and to see that awesome trailer. What's the first movie you saw that made you sit up and say, I don't know if this is good, but my God, this is exciting or weird or sexy or just a bag that you didn't know you had? I know for me, the first movie that confused me in that way was seeing a midnight screening as a young teen of 1975's The Rocky Horror Picture Show. We talk about Rocky Horror in season two of A Year in Film, and you're not going to want to miss that. But a lot of people forget that despite its cult status, it was still produced by 20th Century Fox and received a really wide distribution. What it did do is inspire a generation of movie weirdos, like me, to seek out more unusual fare, movies that may not have had the biggest splash at the box office, but that certainly could be considered influential. Movies that Tim Curry pranced in fishnets for so they could scream at the heavens about killer genitalia while looking fabulous. Movies like Liquid Sky. Alicia, this seems like a movie that you should love. It's New York. It's got a very distinctive visual style. It's fashion. What more do you want?
I want a lot more, Becky, as it turns out. But I do love this film. I love this film for how bold and just inexplicable it is. And nothing, no other film looks like this. No other film sounds like this. No other film feels like this. That being said, I would say everyone needs to see it once and then walk away. That would be my, I'm not saying that in a bad way. Like, it's just, I think our listeners will understand in a minute. But this was the highest grossing independent film of 1983. Now, when you Google Liquid Sky, a lot of you are going to see that it's 1982 is the year that's tied to it. It was released in 83 to the wider public, but did have a showing at the Montreal Film Festival, which actually got its start of its reputation here in Canada in August of 1982. But we're considering it a 1983 film for the purposes of A Year in Film. It's a very rare instance of an independent film produced in the United States by an almost entirely USSR crew. Director Slava Zuckerman, who wrote the film along with star Anne Carlisle and I believe his wife as well, was a pretty successful documentary and commercial director, experienced in making Soviet commercials and documentaries, and then also made films in Israel, and came to New York and kind of fell into the hip. I mean, look, how unhip does it sound when I say the hip scene? I'm very unhip.
Hanging out with those hip.
Oh my God.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not as cool as the people in this film, but
none of us are, Alicia. Know, it's okay. None of us are.
But you think about the scenes that these people were participating in. Now, usually we start the segment with a kind of bit of history. Mm-hmm. Here, it's intrinsically linked to this film. And you can't talk about this film without talking about the scene and how freaking cool these people were. Like, I can't even imagine being
there. Like, I think I've mentioned on this podcast before, I'm born in 1983. I want to hope that if I had been born in, let's say, the mid-60s or early 60s, that I would be cool enough to be part of the scene that was happening in the early 80s in the East Village in New York around places like the Pyramid Club and Club 57 and the Mud Club. This was really where you could go to the East Village on probably a Monday night. I was going to say a Friday night, but that's how big of a loser I am. People party on Mondays. And you could run into Keith Haring. You could see a performance by Klaus Nomi. The opening band could be the B-52s or the Cramps. Like, this was really where New York cool and where art students, which we're going to talk about Star and Carlisle of this film, and she also, Slava Zuckerman didn't write very well in English, so he put her on as a co-writer so that she could kind of translate his screenplay into English. This is really where all the cool kids, the up-and-coming artists, were. And Slava Zuckerman fell into that crowd. He wanted to penetrate the Warhol factory, which he kind of did. He got an early script of this film to Andy Warhol, had written a role for Andy Warhol, who was very interested in it, and it just sort of fell through. He was able to cast Warhol's then lover in a very small role in this, in Liquid Sky. But this is really... this is what happens when very artistic people who have a very distinct vision and are part of a subculture are given carte blanche to do whatever they want. And I say that with love. It does get kind of grating and kind of annoying. Like, this reminds me of like when you would go to an OCAD like student showcase, and there would always be like that one artist that you're like, oh, you are too self-aware for like your own good. You're too...
Or not self-aware enough. Sure,
It's a sci-fi film about heroin addicts who, and I'm speaking really slowly because it gets complicated, who have aliens invade New York and realize that they can feed off of the pheromones that are produced when someone orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
Cam's
way.
Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, close, yes. Close.
So far, this is correct.
There's a club that they all go to, all the characters in the film. There's, you know, an element of like hustling, and it's two lovers, one played by Anne Carlisle, who actually plays a double role. She plays the role of the lead sort of like model, and then she plays a male role who's her antagonist, who's this like kind of rich kid, drug addled, doesn't have enough money, but is always trying to hustle for more heroin. And then her girlfriend is this performance artist played by Polly E. Shepherd, who we'll talk about in a second. It's a lot. If I had to think of a description for what this film looks like, it looks like neon kabuki. Sure. And it sounds like synth scores of nothing but death marches. The lighting in this is unbelievable. And I know there had to be a lot of rehearsals because the way it's lit, which is kind of like day glow, lots of neon, a lot of overexposure, would be very difficult. A lot of these people were not actors, including Anne Carlisle. Like, she was more of a model. So you do get this sort of amateur vibe off of Liquid Sky.
With neon lighting, you actually can't move much. So they did.
It ruins the focus.
So they did rehearse this over and over again using VHS tapes and a handy cam. Mm-hmm. And like, there is like a weird feeling, like a lot of people are like, oh yeah, yeah, you must have been so high. This was a completely anti-drug set. Yeah. No one was doing drugs the entire time.
They were snorting sugar, apparently. It was little piles of sugar. Yeah.
That sounds like a great plan. You know, it's better than the vitamin whatever they had Jonah Hill snorting on that he had to be hospitalized for.
All you hear is any of the fake snortables are, you wish you were doing cocaine.
No good.
Nothing else numbs your nose is the thing.
The one thing I do have to say for this, because like it does have that weird art kid vibe, is that it feels like disciplined art kids. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, this movie was not cheap to make. It's a $500,000 movie. It's a $500,000 movie, which in 1983 is a lot of money. So the fact that they were able to get their hands on this, create this film, find distribution, get it into film festivals, calls, it does speak to a certain level of sophistication.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. I also think it's worth saying that, like you say, that it's this movie about people doing drugs, but none of them did drugs. I think it's a very tongue-in-cheek look at this world, including, it's hard to know if stuff like Rhythm Box is such a good song, but it seems like it's also kind of, she gives a eulogy for a dead person that's pretty goofy. So it seems like all of this is skewering this scene just as much as it's celebrating.
Well, I think it's key to note that it's directed by an outsider. Like, Anne Carlisle was very much an insider, but Slava Zuckerman and his partner were coming directly from Israel to New York, and, you know, were raised in the USSR during the Cold War. That's a very outside view. I can only imagine arriving to New York and going to these clubs for the first time and seeing, like, Klaus Nomi in those classic, iconic costumes. I can only imagine what that would have been like for someone behind the Iron Curtain. And,
well,
like,
in interviews, Nina Vikarova, Slava's partner, she claims that she was actually in a gulag in Russia, and that she learned a lot of her craft by speaking to the artists there, like super high-end artists, teaching her how to do these different things and how to do storytelling and filmmaking and everything, because, you know, that's where all the artists were.
I mean, that's a talking point for emerging film students, to, like, get out of film school and just immerse yourself in a gulag.
Film school is its own kind of gulag, yeah. I think all film students would tell you, and you're definitely not going to make any money
I went to theater school. It is an endurance test, let me tell you.
It's an interesting thing too, because, like you say, it is so avant-garde. I mean, the cinematographer Yuri Naiman, he's mostly a teacher now, but his films are known for these crazy visuals. He did the remake of DOA, which is a really insanely shot movie. I also think it's very interesting when we talk about these neon colors, it's easy to look at this film now and say, oh, well, yeah, that, you know, 80s neon, but that their fashion choices were actually incredibly avant-garde for the early 80s. Yeah. The movie we're going to talk about next is much more what the fashion was like at the time. And there's actually, interestingly, a collection by Steven Sprouse, a New York designer, in 1983, which I think is hugely influenced by Liquid Sky. You can see some of the exact outfits from Liquid Sky in his collection. And that collection is what a lot of people point to, the eventual, like, popularity of Dayglow. I don't need to give you the Devil Wears Prada speech, but it's like, that is what trickled down into popular neon stuff, which was actually a much more late 80s, early 90s phenomenon.
There's a couple costumes and outfits in here that Anne Carlisle wears that you're like, Lady Gaga. That's exactly early,
Lady Gaga. I would love to know if Lady Gaga has seen this. I'm sure she has.
Of course she's seen this.
I love Lady Gaga. I'm so curious what her impression. This is a huge film I discovered in the burlesque scene, at least in Toronto. Like, there's a really notable burlesque artist named Laura Desiree, who has an Anne Carlisle act that I was very excited about. So I mean there's love for this film in other subcultures. Like, by virtue of it being about subcultures, it then will attract other subcultures into loving it.
Oh, sure.
It also, like, we talked about the opening scene a little bit in this club, and I love movies that invite you to be a part of the scene immediately. So you're actually in there dancing with them, hanging out, doing stuff.
I guess one thing to point out, and it's a bit of a trigger warning, is, and this is actually, I think, a merit to the film, you know, there are, I think, more than one rape scenes in this, but they're done, I thought they were done very it's weird to say they're done well, but you know what I'm saying. They're done very sophisticatedly.
Tastefully, tactfully.
Actually quite realistically in terms of how that kind of violence is enacted. And it's really to Anne Carlisle, who, you know, the lead actress in this film, to her merit. Like, she really performs very well. And I know they practice, you're talking about the dress rehearsals, they practice those scenes over and over again so that it would demystify sort of that violence and not put her in a place where she was very uncomfortable.
That's called a safe set. That's a good thing.
Yeah, and, like, now today we have things like intimacy coordinators and you know, obviously in 1983 that's not a thing on a set. But I'm impressed, you know, in reading an interview that she did that I think Slava was part of too, where she described that, like, they really, everything, as much as I'm saying, like, this feels like an OCAD showcase, it's not. Every decision is made very cogently and very actively, and It's just too much, though, Becky. It's too much. Like, if I could watch this in 10-minute spurts over a week, I think I would love it. But by like the 40-minute mark, I was kind of like rocking back and forth.
Well, I mean, it's also, it's interesting you brought it up alongside Rocky Horror, because it really made a lot of its money as a midnight movie at the Waverly, the same way Rocky Horror did. So yeah, it's a movie that I think is best enjoyed perhaps on a substance or two or three. And yeah, it's worth also saying that pretty much every rapist gets brained by an alien. Mm-hmm. So you can at least be happy there. But yeah, it's a very unusual. I mean, I think it's huge with the queer community, partially because of Anne Carlyle playing these two roles. And it's interesting because she was a big part of this kind of avant-garde new wave modeling agency called La Rocca at the time, which you Google them. I sent Alicia a lookbook by them, and it's super
they
awesome.
They are all so tall, and they are all so skinny.
Alicia yeah, just so got this like looking. Big grin on her face. Like, yeah. I wish listeners could see how excited
and
you are.
They were among the first people, and Carlyle says, to have dyed hair. And they worked a lot with this salon that's very famous called Sinandre, which was, if you look them up online, they were called the Studio 54 of
Can
hair.
Can I just say, Cam, I'm just so impressed with you right now. Like, this is like a niche that I did not expect you to come up.
Honestly, I was just very interested in it. And Anne Carlyle loves talking about this movie. Mm-hmm. She's a very interesting person. Yeah. She said she actually modeled more as Jimmy, as that androgynous male look.
I have to admit, when I first started watching this, it took me a little bit to figure out they were two different people. I was they cast well, but
I mean, she also
person.
She has a wonderful story where she always kind of wanted to play Jimmy. They cast someone else as Jimmy who did not show up.
Yeah, he dropped out.
He just disappeared. But she really wanted to be Jimmy, and she eventually, they were on a location scout, and she said, listen, let me prove that I can do Jimmy. And she did it by walking up to a woman and hitting on her and getting her number, which is amazing.
Anne Carlyle is a badass.
She's a badass. And she's an interesting woman. She went on to act in Crocodile Dundee and a couple other things. But she actually decided to quit acting due to the AIDS crisis. She kind of felt that she couldn't continue in such a frivolous thing. And she went back to school to become an art therapist, primarily to work with AIDS patients. So it's a very kind of interesting choice. Both of these actresses actually did not have long continuing careers after Liquid Sky.
No, Paula E. Shepherd, who I really love her in this film, because she's just like, she plays this balance between like being really nasty and manipulative and horrible, and you still being like, yeah, but you're kind of cool, and I kind of wish you were my friend. You know, like, it's a very predatory place that I have fallen into that trap more than once. You know?
And I mean, she's a fascinating actress, because it's worth saying she is incredibly diminutive. She is a very short woman, but she has such a power behind her.
She has such a childlike face, which makes her role in this film when she's like threatening to cut someone really effective. Like, she does look like a child, I find.
Well, she's terrifying, and that's why in when she was 19 years old, she was cast in her only other role, which is the horror film Alice, Sweet Alice, which also gave us Brooke Shields, which if people haven't seen that one, man, that's a good one. That's something that should pop up in a horror film.
I'm going to watch it this week. I'm excited.
Oh, man.
It's another one I would say maybe worth watching, but I hesitate at good ones.
For me, it's like if you have any sort of like religious stuff,
sure,
it's like it hits those buttons real good.
If you're a Catholic, you'll be blown away.
It's just upsetting. And also Brooke Shields is just awesome because, you know, Brooke Shields. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she's just an interesting human being who just disappeared. And like, there's no track of what she did or she doesn't do interviews. Everyone's like, yeah, she was amazing in two movies and she disappeared.
Changed her name,
did
apparently.
She?
Yes. People believe she is a nurse in Seattle.
But, oh my God, this is
amazing. She likely
changed
her name. She also, it's interesting because the statement is she wanted a more nurturing career than acting. So both her and Anne Carlyle kind of moved in the same
path.
And
yet they're like so iconic and so famous because of this one film. Mm-hmm. It's really like a testament to Liquid Sky.
We should also say too that this, in the film, they refer to heroin as Liquid Sky and this concept of euphoria. But before this movie, that was not a euphemism for heroin. This
gave the name heroin
Liquid Sky. Apparently, the term Liquid Sky comes from, I believe it's like a Greek poem that refers to that as euphoria and just this like above state.
Before I saw this film, I was getting Vanilla Sky and Liquid Sky confused.
Very different movies.
Very upsetting to me.
Here's an easy way to tell them apart. Never watch Vanilla Sky. yeah, look around at the scene of 1983 and enjoy it, and just know that this movie is so visually influential. Even if it has a soundtrack that's like a full moon feature horror movie, it's I'm sure that was avant-garde for the time. What do I know?
There's something with the score. It's called I might be getting this wrong. Electro Clash. It kind of designated its own genre of music that I am very repelled by. So.
But yeah, the 2000s electro clash movement is hugely influenced. You are correct.
Okay, good.
Kids today, Gen Z will probably be baffled by electro clash, but you know, it was the 100 gecs of its day, kids.
I'm just going to keep listening to my 1920s radio shows. that's what I'm comfortable with.
I think the other thing that kind of amazes me about this film is that it was aimed at a mainstream audience. At least they claim it was. They were hoping that it would come off of Close Encounters of the Third Kind with the alien bit. The people were like, oh, it's like that. And that also it's a Cinderella story, and it's a housewife wanting to be punk, and she comes from nowhere, and then she does this. So it's interesting that they were kind of hoping more mainstream people would like really be able to relate to this. And it's like, no. This is very much a time capsule of certain people, and like the weird that need to find this will find this.
Could you imagine if, like, let's say the world is destroyed, aliens come to Earth and they want to learn about Earthlings, and they have this film, which is very meta because it's about aliens. But I'm just like, it's so I can't. If someone asked me, like, what's one of the most unique visions you've ever seen outside of, like, let's say the silent era, I'd be like, Liquid Sky.
Yeah. Well, and also we didn't even get into the whole thing at the end where the Anne Carlisle character, Margaret, not Jimmy, although Jimmy gets killed by Margaret, ends up killing people with her genitalia. She ends up murdering people in that way, but they sort of disappear as she's having sex with them. It's a very weird thing.
I think people should watch this film. Like I say, just watch it. And then walk away.
It's hard to explain. Definitely don't watch it twice in 1 year like Alicia and I did. That's the mistake.
Then you start to see the holes.
I just worry I'm going to get infected by aliens, I think.
All right. Well, we talked about the scenesters in this, and that's very much one way that the new wave went. But the other direction was in this dark, broody, shadowy sort of world, which was goth, and it was pioneered by bands like Joy Division, Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, and the band that provided our next film's iconic opening song and performance, Bauhaus. If you went to a goth club in most cities from like the mid-80s to today, you'll find that most of the people there were trying to juggle looking mysterious, breathing in a corset, and deciding if they want to dance with the guy their friends have dubbed Jeff the Perfectly Serviceable Goth. But the aspiration...
Sorry. Apologies.
But the aspiration of every goth kid, even if they don't want to admit it, was to look as effortlessly cool as the people in the opening of Tony Scott's The Hunger. Cam, you grew up in Edmonton like I did. You probably went to the similar clubs that I did. You know the kind of people I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Goth, weirdly huge in Edmonton. Edmonton loves a subculture. I think, I don't know if it made it into the final cut, but in A Year in Film, I've talked about the huge ska revival in early 2000s Edmonton.
You have no idea.
It's niche. But it's a very interesting thing. And this movie is absolutely, it's the one that a lot of people point to because it's so visual and so sexy. It's not my favorite movie, but it definitely, you can't deny that it's beautiful. And I think a lot of that has to do with Tony Scott, who is really trying to make his mark. He, of course, started out, he's the brother of Ridley Scott. He followed a lot in Ridley's footsteps, but he actually had ambition to become a painter. That was his big thing. But when he graduated from art school, Ridley had become famous enough that he had Ridley Scott Associates sort of little production company, and he was like, Tony, please take it over, make commercials, you'll pay off your student debts. And Tony ended up being a relatively famous commercial director, much like Ridley was. And as we talked about last time with Adrian Lyne, there was this huge wave of Brits who worked in commercials coming over. And actually, Tony saw that. Tony saw his compatriots like Alan Parker, Hugh Hudson, who just had won the Oscar for Chariots of Fire. He saw them making big Hollywood careers. So he started to plan his. And actually, a part of his plan, which never came to fruition, was an adaptation of Interview with the Vampire, which had come out in the 1970s, the Anne Rice novel. He really wanted to do it. He was pitching it around. And when he pitched it to a certain studio, they were like, oh, we have a vampire movie. It's called The Hunger.
Do you want this?
Do you want to do it? And he went, close enough. And he brought his style, this kind of sumptuous. He was known, he calls himself a rock and roll filmmaker. And he just went on to create this kind of wild, glossy movie that really, I think, pushed the goth sensibility further.
Yeah, and very much created that definitive style of like the smaller dark glasses and like, I mean, it resonates forward into Interview with the Vampire and like some mm-hmm. of the modern eras there, right? Where it's like the collared shirts and mm-hmm. the not quite waistcoats, but very tailored sort of jackets. And it's, I mean, it is David Bowie too, who you put anything on him and he
sure,
looks amazing.
Yeah, David Bowie, Catherine Deneuve, and Susan Sarandon. I mean,
ridiculous.
What more do you want?
Yeah, this is the three sexiest people. And apparently, now, according to Susan Sarandon, she did say this posthumously of David Bowie's death, the two of them became lovers. And there is this really delightful contemporary interview from 1983 with Susan Sarandon and David Bowie, where they sit together on a couch, like almost Barbara Walters-y style. And they just have the most wonderful chemistry.
Do you like being famous?
That's always interested me as well, the aspect of really crying out for attention when you first start, and then when you receive it, you don't want it anymore. So you do your best to sort of avoid interviews and avoid being photographed. And there's a time in your life when you sort of, you give your right arm to be photographed and, mm-hmm. and asked your opinion. Yeah.
But you can get a seat in a restaurant. That's...
This was a book before it was a film, and I kind of teased this earlier. The Hunger was written by one of the most outspoken and famous alien abductees in the world, or experiencer, which is the accepted term within the UFO researcher community, who is Whitley Strieber. He was on track to be like the next Stephen King. Almost as soon as they were published, his first novels were turned into feature films, including Wolfen, The Hunger. Later on, they would adapt one of his novels to be The Day After Tomorrow. Not great film, but awesome visuals. And the big one was Communion, which is based on his, of course, being an experiencer. The movie Communion, it starred Christopher Walken, and it gave us the image of the little gray alien with the big black eyes that we all know and are, quite frankly, terrified by. Funny side note, just so you can get an idea of Whitley Strieber in your head, Dan Aykroyd actually campaigned to play him in the film, and he lost it to Walken. And Whitley was like, yeah, that would have been way more accurate. Anyway, his mainstream career was almost totally derailed by his speaking out publicly about his time with aliens, including an implant he says he has behind his ear that helps him write and moves away from scalpels when people try to investigate it surgically. The general consensus of people who have not actually assessed this human being is that he has temporal lobe epilepsy, which is one of the reasons we have for alien abduction experiences, is that it's these little seizures that happen that cause us to hallucinate in different ways in the frontal lobe. He claims he's been tested for it and doesn't have it. But yeah, it's just a fascinating human being who also wrote this fantastic book about vampires.
I just love that you're debunking the existence of aliens on this podcast.
I did not expect it to go in this route.
I thought you were going to say... It's commonly known that aliens do not exist.
I also thought it would be about Liquid Sky and not The Hunger when Becky finally debunks alien abductions.
True. No, those heroin aliens exist, just not the gray one.
Pretty well. But we're talking about vampires. We're back into vampires, not aliens. And so, like, this also isn't your traditional way of looking at vampires either, that which also makes it very unique. Alicia, you love the vampires. Like, how does this resonate for you?
You know what?
I've seen you talk about Dracula. I know.
The embrace of the grave.
Yeah, I laughed to disguise my hubris. It's true. There's so few vampire films that I dislike. I'm a sucker for them. I'm a sucker for this film. This film is pretty divisive, I think. There's people who, I think generally everyone acknowledges this looks incredible.
Yeah,
I don't know how you could ever fault its cinematography, its costume design, both of which we'll talk about in a minute. However, as a vampire film, there is very little that happens and very little plot. and a lot of sort of wayward storylines. I'm fine with that. A film that looks this good can do whatever it wants. I think it's more about creating a mood. If we're talking about the goth subculture, which is a very moody subculture, seems like Tony Scott was more interested in the mood of the moment than whether any of the storylines added up. I watched this with a friend recently who I love watching films with her, and she never has a review of the film right away. She always waits until the next day to let me know what she thought. And her review was, "I thought it looked very good. I was very frustrated by how all of the upholstery in their house was white, because if they were going to murder all these people, who cleaned up the couches?" That was her only response to this film, which I get where she's coming from, because it's a fantasy film. It's a horror film. You're not supposed to, you know, vampires don't exist. Therefore, why are we scrutinizing if the couch has been scotch guarded or not? But I do understand that line of thinking, because there's something slightly missing from this film. I just ultimately do not give a damn, because it looks amazing. And if you have Catherine Deneuve, Susan Sarandon, and David Bowie, and a Bauhaus, that the first 20 minutes of this film, which I believe David Bowie has once referenced, are impeccable. There's a recently, you know, we're doing this in 2020. There was recently a meme that went around, a viral video of, it's a black and white video of bats all hanging upside down from their cage. And if they just reverse the video, so they're actually looking like they're upright, and then they put it to this music and they're all like dancing. It's like just the average goth club. Like, I love, this is one of my favorite memes. It was so, for me, The Hunger. This film goes back centuries. It opens in some ways in the Egyptian times, with Catherine Deneuve as like an Egyptian goddess, when she's her vampirism goes back all the way to there. It then flashes forward to the neoclassical era in the early 1800s, or perhaps the 1700s. Then we're in like 1980s New York. Like, I love that kind of time travel, and I don't think it's necessary. It's all just sort of like frosting, goth frosting.
Sure.
Which is black. Because, I mean, this is vampirism. And we talked about it in an earlier episode about how a lot of people were looking back at a movie and making it like it's an AIDS allegory.
Yeah.
But this is, again, this is not part of that.
This is me being a real specific axe to grind. But I feel like 1983 actually has two movies that are often misattributed as AIDS metaphors, I believe. The Hunger and The Fly.
Mm.
The truth is that 1983 is really the tipping point of HIV/AIDS as we know it. At the time, it was still called GRID, most popularly, with the gay-related immunity disorder, which, yeah, I mean, obviously that got changed.
Not a problematic name at all.
No. Yes. But it was just beginning to be mentioned in stuff like the New York Times, which actually helped popularize AIDS as a term. You have to just remember that films take a long time to make. As much as I'm sure people like David Bowie were aware of the impending crisis, it just wouldn't be involved in movies. And David Cronenberg has gone far enough to say that The Fly is just about aging and disease. And I think that this is very much the same kind of feeling in this film. The thing to note, what made the later vampire movies in the 1980s so seemingly related to AIDS was, of course, the fact that AIDS is related to blood. And that information was just coming out in 1983. So unless they, shot this as they read medical journals and then released it a week later, the truth is that this is the one of the last pre-AIDS vampire movies. And also, it's interestingly, as I say, there's a big vampire boom, but this actually predates that as well.
Yeah.
That big swell of vampire movies really happened from 1985 onward.
Well, and I'm actually really glad that you brought that up. Because when we talk about A Year in Film in our 1992 episode on Bram Stoker's Dracula, which Becky referenced me being a fanatic for, which I am, the whole like idea of yoking horror and relating it to the AIDS crisis kind of comes up around an Amy Tobin article that's written in Film Comment in, I think 93, on Alien 3, the David Fincher film.
Hmm.
And I remember reading that and as a film student, and I think I did exactly what bothers you, Cam, is I then went backwards and started attributing films like The Hunger and films like even Liquid Sky to the AIDS crisis. So I'm very happy that you pointed that out, that it really kind of occurs more in the early 90s when there was more known about AIDS and HIV. And, you're right. Films take a long time to conceive, especially if they're based on books. Like, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Like,
and it's also a great queer film. So there's like nothing. And I don't want to be the metaphor police. you can choose to read whatever you want into anything. But I think it's always important, especially if you're theorizing, to know what the intentions the filmmakers likely had.
But this also has a whole new take on the vampire mythos itself, in that it's actually a bloodborne pathogen that causes Catherine Deneuve's companions to rapidly age if they don't get a certain amount of it, and that they just kind of die off before she does, which also very much an AIDS thing. I can see putting it on.
Yeah, I can absolutely see why people think this is an AIDS metaphor. Same with the fly.
They don't have fangs. They have these little knives that they slice people's
things with.
And
it's worth saying
they
never say the word vampire. It's an interesting movie in that regard. But yeah, it definitely seems like an AIDS metaphor. It's just the big tragedy of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s was it was relatively ignored by mass culture.
But Alicia, you talked about this being a very sexy film, and it most certainly is. And this is one of the first instances in a mainstream film of a lesbian sex scene, which is handled actually really well and very sexy.
Yeah, it's obviously between Catherine Deneuve, who is someone that, as an actress, she's obviously French, has been linked to sort of sexy European films for a very long time, especially if you want to just pick one out, like Louis Buñuel's Belle de Jour, which was kind of about S&M and, sexual fantasies. And so it's not unusual for Catherine Deneuve to be cast this way. I think just putting her lover being Susan Sarandon, what's one of the most attractive women like of all time. She still like looks insanely great. It's just shot really well. It's shot almost like a music video, and it isn't
and it's
super
dreamy and ethereal.
It's surreal and ethereal, and it's not necessarily there's not a ton of voyeurism in the shot or the camera angles. It's not really focused much on nudity either. It's just an intimacy that they achieve, almost like an emotional and intellectual intimacy that they can achieve in this physical act. And it's just, I think it's one of my favorite sex scenes. One of my favorite sex scenes is Bram Stoker's Dracula, 1992. So like, this is like not quite there, but it's like, it's close to that.
I also think it's like, this is maybe a hot take and maybe somebody can correct me on it, but I feel like it's probably very influential on the late 80s and 90s softcore. Like, if I think of a Zalman King scene, for instance,
I love Zalman King.
I think it's very influenced by this. And I mean, as much as there were Radley Metzgers and things before this that were making erotica with sumptuous visuals, something about the lighting of Tony Scott, something about the music, I think really must have inspired a lot of the softcore filmmakers that would follow.
You could just cut out the sex scene and do an entire Showcase Drambuie review.
It's a real Red Shoe Diary.
Yeah, for non-Canadians listening, I'm sorry. It's just a very specific Canadian thing that we had on late night television in the 90s, sponsored by Drambuie, the liqueur, where a lot of softcore kind of erotica thriller films were shown.
Wasn't it at one point hosted by Cameron Bailey, who is now the head of the TIFF Bell Lightbox,
or
TIFF in general?
I would prefer not to comment on that.
It was him and Valerie Bahajar. But yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things too is this is a part of a long history of lesbian vampire erotica too. Like, I mean, it goes back to the book Carmilla, but. Yeah, it's interesting when you bring up those old late night movies, because you'd be as likely to see a lot of the Jess Franco, Vampiros Lesbos, or any number of those, or the old Hammer ones where they're biting each other's breasts. Mm-hmm. Vampires have always been a way to kind of like insert a little bit of erotica.
Yeah, by making it fantasy, all of a sudden then it's kind of sort of, if it's fantasy, then it's sanitized.
And
it's not
the lesbian usually gets killed, even in this case.
That's pretty standard. Yeah. But this is also about intimacy, right? And about switching, about having partners and choosing to be with someone for a long time. That like, because you're with them for a long time. And there's my personal favorite scene of this is actually the shower scene with David Bowie. Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie have just killed two people from the club and they then shower off. And he just looks at her and he's like, forever. And the two of them just start snogging it out. And I'm like, that's for me.
I mean,
that was written for me. I wasn't born, but it's written for me.
Not to be the man underlining the point, But I think, you know, if I was to send home a workbook with the teenagers, I would say, what is the hunger in The Hunger? And I would say that it is the hunger for intimacy in a partner, because yeah. Catherine Deneuve is driven to put these people through horrible hell. It's why yeah. she's really a monster. It's not the drinking the blood. It's the turning these people, knowing that they will not live forever, lying to them.
When my friend made the couch anecdote and I tried to explain why I like this film and tried to go beyond just the style of it, I was like, if you just think of the film entirely as a breakup film, like what happens when you break up with someone and the psychological damage and you rebound with, you always have like another partner in the wings when you know shit's hitting the fan, and then, which would be the little girl in this film who gets killed off very brutally, and then instantly Deneuve is attracted to Susan Sarandon. Like, there's this sort of food chain of intimacy and trying your hardest to grapple with needing companionship when it can't be forever, because Catherine Deneuve's character knows it can't be forever. It's happened to all of her lovers. They are literally all in a coffin up in the attic, writhing in pain. Writhing or
writhing?
Writhing.
Withering is actually probably appropriate.
Well, they are actually withering, that's true. And they're all, like, she knows every time she engages a new partner that it's not forever. Sorry, Becky, to smash your fantasy of that shower scene.
David Bowie is forever and in all our hearts. Yeah, okay.
But it's, the idea of, like, disengaging and disconnecting from someone that you've been, in this case, connected to for, what, 400 years?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's also worth noting, I will say that I find this movie a bit dull. The visuals are not enough to keep my attention, but it does have some really great classic horror moments, too. Like you say, the girl being killed. It has wonderful makeup from Dick Smith, who's known for a lot of his gory creations. And the ending is wonderful, kind of crazy, over-the-top horror in a way that I found really, really pleasing after being a little bored by 20 minutes of erotica.
Well, we should bring this into Tony Scott as well, because Tony Scott would later be very, very famous for a number of films, including Top Gun. But after this film, he genuinely thought his career was over.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it took the fact, as we've mentioned in the previous episode, talking about Flashdance, the two people who were very taken with The Hunger were Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer. Mm-hmm. And they actually approached Ridley and then approached Tony to make Top Gun. And they were very concerned, essentially, with Top Gun. What they cared most about was a very visual director. They also approached David Cronenberg, apparently. They were looking for people with very unique visual styles. So the fact that this film is criticized often as style over substance actually helped Tony Scott. He says he doesn't mind that criticism because he's so proud of the style. It's interesting to talk about David Bowie because it's a interesting time for his career. Let's Dance had come out, which was a massive commercial success, I believe his most successful album, but a massive critical flop. Critics hated it. They considered him a real sellout at the time. It forced him to do this massive world tour where he stopped in little places like Winnipeg and Edmonton in Canada, which created some of the highest selling concerts of all time in Canada. But he also had a huge coming out as an actor. He's been in a few roles before, but in 1983, along with The Hunger, he had Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
I love that.
He had a cameo in Yellowbeard. Interestingly, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, while it was filmed in the 70s, was really properly released in 1983. Mm-hmm. So he was a man who was all over the cinemas.
He was pretty uncomfortable with being in The Hunger as well, and weirdly wanted to be in Top Gun.
The Hunger, I felt very uncomfortable with that role, although I loved being involved in a Tony Scott movie. I thought Tony was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And his second film being Top Gun, I thought, why did you give me your first film, Tony?
I think he doesn't like violence, is the truth. He quite often, he has a great quote that says, there's nothing that looks like it, but I'm worried that it's just perversely bloody at some points. And also, as you say, he has the shadiest quote of, wow, those first 20 minutes really rattle along, huh? And it's like, oh, Mr. Boy, what do you think of the rest of the film? Yeah. He's good in it.
He's great.
That, interesting. Like, I mean, no knock on Deneuve. I think she does a wonderful job. I think Deneuve and Sarandon are great. But
Deneuve,
I think,
just doesn't get a lot to do. I think that's the biggest thing.
He gets so much to do because he has this crazy aging that he does so wonderfully. Yeah. So it's just like a fascinating performance for
David
Bowie.
He's almost like a universal monster.
Oh, yeah. True. It's like, a very creepy thing. And again, at the end, it's wonderful to see. No spoilers, but maybe he comes back.
But I also alluded to his commitment to his performance. He would go on the George Washington Bridge and scream every punk lyric he knew to get his voice raspy to play those older character scenes. And it's like, you understand you could have given yourself nodules and ended your career, right? Like, you could have finished it all.
Yeah, he'd already gone half blind from like an incident on set. And then,
Isn't that also, was it Lauren Bacall who said she ran out into the desert and screamed until she had her raspy voice? Some classical, raspy, smoky actress, I believe, said that was her thing. She ran out into the desert and just screamed until she couldn't scream anymore.
Man, I don't know about you guys, but I can kind of empathize with Lauren Bacall at this point, because this has been an awesome episode. I've really enjoyed talking to both of you. So we're going to wrap this up, but I want to once again thank Alicia Fletcher. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Becky. Make sure everyone sees that bat upside down goth club meme. That's like more than the hunger. Just watch the 13-second bat meme. Thank you.
Cam, thank you so much. This is such a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Let's do this podcast forever. Question mark? I don't know.
And of course, that's everything for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. And you can join us again in 2 weeks, where we're going to discuss a film that pioneered queer cinema in the 90s and also contains the single longest shot to date of a carpet. Longer than The Shining, even. That's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
But they just don't understand us, new women. After all, every now and then a girl's gotta get out and dance. Catch my drift?